Blog Talk Radio.
Hey everybody, this is Jarrett Middleton from Dark Coast Press and Pharos Editions, hanging out and chatting with Jonathan Evison today. How you doing, Johnny?
I'm doing good. How are you, my friend?
I'm doing good. We actually have some sun in Seattle. Where are you in
I'm out at the cabin in Squim, and it's nice. It's roof. I'm guessing it's about 70 degrees, really sunny.
Did you, you've been on the road for a while, right? Did you get back
home?
Yeah,
about 30 cities. I just got back from Booktopia in Bellingham, which was awesome. It's really fun. It was like, we do all these book events that are generally, industry related with booksellers and everything like that. So there's always this sort of jaded air of gloom hanging somewhere in the background. But this was just pure readers that came from all over, and it was fun because you talked to big crowds. I talked about 200-300 people, and they'd all read the book and stuff, which is refreshing because, when you're on tour, it's like part of you feels like a shill, Like you can't really talk about the book because you don't want to spoil it because most people are going to buy it then. But, yeah, it was really fun. Check it out, Booktopia. They move it around to a city every year, and people come from all over the world. It's really, really unique and excellent event.
Did you have events up at Village Books?
Yeah, some of it was at Village Books, and some of it was at my hotel in the kind of conference center.
How many authors was it? I think I saw Carolyn Levitt.
There's only six of us, I think, so it's pretty cool. Like, all the people that attend get to have a chance to see everybody. They schedule the sessions really well. I was really impressed. I mean, it's one of those book-related events that really gives me hope that, the publishing is getting smarter.
Yeah.
Sort of like Pharos Editions. I think it's a really smart idea. I think it brings value to the publishing world. I think it exposes people to classic literature, but it also, ties into the modern paradigm.
So for those who don't know, Dark Coast Press in Seattle is an indie literary fiction publisher that I co-founded and edit for. And recently this year, we started Pharos Editions, a new imprint that sort of flipped the classics series type of model that a lot of people are doing so well, like New York Review of Books and Melville House and projects like that that do such a great job. We kind of inverted it a bit, and we approached contemporary authors that we were either friends or colleagues with, such as Johnny, as well as Jess Walter, Sherman Alexie, and Matt Groening from The Simpsons. And we asked them what, if any, books that they have relationships with that they love that are hard to find or out of print. And then we would go track down the rights and release them all in a nice series with sort of a series look and tight packaging. So the first four titles, The Pharos, released June 5th, so they're in stores now. And we just debuted the books for trade at Book Expo America in New York. And we have a local release party here in Seattle at the Town Hall tomorrow night, Tuesday night, June 11th, $5 at the door, 7 p.m. And Johnny, Jess Walter, and Sherman, three of the four first authors, are going to be on a panel hosted by Paul Constant, the book reviews editor at The Stranger. So Jonathan chose McTeague by Frank Norris as one of the first four. Talk about your pick a little bit, Johnny, and then your personal relationship with it and how it was writing an introduction for a book that you love.
Yeah, well, McTeague was a book that I sort of dating this editor when I was about 19 years old. She worked at University of Washington Press, and she said, "You got to read this book, McTeague." And I read it, and I instantly fell in love with it. And it's one of those books that I revisit, every few years. Probably read it five or six times. It's usually, in a way, it's kind of generally not. It's not the kind of book I would write necessarily. It's just this really gritty, sort of realism that I think is just such a nice, you know, came out in 1899, and it's, I consider it to be like the last great American novel of the 19th century. But, you know, it's such a nice antidote to the Victorian novel.
The novel, you know, of manners. It's an anti-novel of manners.
Yeah, yeah. And even Dickens, who sort of subverted the Victorian novel, I mean, this is still, and you know, there's definitely some Dickens DNA and Norris, too, in terms of social consciousness and so forth. But, you know, without spoiling anything for readers, McTeague does not end in a wedding. You know what I'm saying? I mean, it's as far as you can get from the wedding at the end. But it's just, I don't know, it's an amazingly sort of brutal portrait. It's hilarious, too. I mean, I don't know if I'm alone in thinking it's hilarious, but I just think...
I've been carrying that torch, too. And I don't know if many readers agree, but I think it's got a dark, twisted black humor to it.
Yeah, I mean, for me, McTeague reminds me of the Dude, kind of. I mean, he's just such a clod, and the modern world is passing him by, and he's just kind of a bum sitting around his dumpy flat drinking steam beer, and he's like really kind of a half-assed dentist, which is a scary proposition. And I think it's hilarious that like he falls in love with Trina while working on her teeth, because that's just sort of a delightfully disgusting concept to me. I don't know, the novel is so good. The writing is just so perfectly suited to it. I mean, Norris is just such a gritty, like, just kind of a brutal prose style. And I really think, you know, and he was famous in his time for, as he said, "I never truckled." I don't even know what that means. I think it means basically you never compromised. But he was quite the maverick for his time. I mean, upon the release of McTeague, it was pretty much universally, you know, there was outrage. I mean, it was very, very ahead of its time. So
yeah,
I had the opportunity, and now McTeague of the other, you know, of course, I was the first one to pick, so I didn't really have any other context. So, you know, I picked what I considered to be, I mean, it is a classic, but it's a very underread classic, and I'm not sure if it's out of print, but, I mean, it's pretty much stayed in print most of its, you know, 125-year history. But I just jumped at the opportunity to be able to write about this book and share it with people.
You know, that's what's been so fun about publishing Pharos, especially with the debut list, that each of the four authors we approached, you being the first, all the books are so wildly different, and everybody's got that relationship with one book that they've got in their minds and their history that they love so much, and there isn't a modern version. Now, McTeague was the only one of the four that was public domain, because it is the 19th century, it's 1899. So it was the least complicated in terms of securing it. And you know, there are obviously copies out there. People have read it in curriculums and college courses and whatnot, but I don't think there's sort of a modern version, and certainly none with your intro. But I think out of the four...
It really is such a modern book.
It is. It's grown. I think it's even stylistically, you know, a lot of the... utterance style of dialogue, and it's got a lot of -hyphen, you know, type of broken up kind of quick cut prose. A lot of that stuff wasn't stylistically popular at the end of the 19th century. It is now.
Yeah, and I think as a stylist, Norris gets better with age. I think at the time he wasn't considered a great stylist because, you know, his language is not... anyway, sort of flowery and Victorian. It's, like I said, it's just very brutal. I think I said in the intro how he just sort of like, his sentences just sort of pulverize language at times, but it just so works, you know, with this story. And I got to say, I'm really, really excited to read Jess's pick, particularly Robert Cantwell's novel. I'm really excited to, because I'd heard the name Cantwell, and I know that Fitzgerald and Hemingway and a lot of writers of the Jazz Age were really into Cantwell, but he's one of these guys that kind of like Kerry McWilliams or something, the California writer who just kind of, you know, I guess the Academy never quite embraced them, so they sort of fell out under the radar. So totally excited to read that. I also want to read Sherman's pick, Todd Walton's book, and I'm excited to read Matt's pick too. So
for those who haven't seen it, other than McTeague by Frank Norris, Sherman Alexie chose Inside Moves, a 1980 basketball novel by Todd Walton, which was actually a film directed by Richard Donner about a handicapped basketball player who takes his hand at turning pro for the Golden State Warriors. Sherman, as most readers know, is a basketball nut, and his introduction for the book starts, I was a few weeks late turning in this introduction to my editors because I broke my jaw playing basketball.
And, you know, I'm a kind of a basketball nut too, so three of the four, I don't know about Matt, but, you know, basketball is really the only sport I've ever written about in any of my novels. And I write about it, you know, there's a basketball scene in Lulu. There's basketball in West of Here.
Even though you have that great American nostalgia for baseball, I think, don't you?
I do, but you know what I mean? It's just been written about so much.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's kind of funner about, you know, the nuances of basketball just have not been, you know, written about nearly as much, I don't think. When is that great hockey novel coming, by the way?
I know. It's
people who don't know Jarrett Middleton, new hockey fans will recognize that last name, Middleton, as a big name in Boston Bruin annals.
Who are now,
has there been a great hockey book? Has anyone written kind of a
definitive? There's no great hockey book yet.
Well, get busy, buddy.
I think I've got to do it. It's a reckoning from the distant future.
Meanwhile, I'm working on the great ping pong novel, maybe. We'll see.
Yeah, you're getting your practice in out there in the Squim. No, I feel like I should. Everybody always asks me, you know, and I've got all this work. I'm in the middle of a novel now. And I've got at least another year or two of work in front of me that I'm so excited to write, but it's always this lingering thing. It's just, I think other than books and probably booze, I know the most about hockey. And I don't know. I never knew how I would treat it, whether I would do, you know, like David Foster Wallace always putting tennis sort of slyly and secondarily in his plots, or what Sherman does with basketball. To write about it sort of indirectly, just aesthetically always having it present, or to actually write almost like
about a hockey player or something. Yeah, right.
Yeah, have a main character, or even, I guess, a third option would be down the road, if I ever got into that, you know, creative nonfiction memoir type thing about my youth and growing up with my father being a professional. I don't know.
Yeah,
something in the vein of like Andre Dubas III's County. When that book came out, I think it was last year, a year and a half ago, I had two different people send it to me and say, this just sounds verbatim like how you grew up. And I read it, and I think I lived in the same exact towns in the same exact order as Andre the Third. All these sort of post-industrial hellholes north of Boston, all along the Merrimack River. I don't know. I'll write about it.
You better do it before some Canadian author beats you to the punch.
That's true. You know, I should look into that. You know there's got to be a handful of good Canadian hockey novels.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm so bad on Canadian. I'm actually reading a Canadian novel right now by a woman named Lynn Cody that my friend recommended to me highly, and it's really good so far. It's called The Antagonist. So I'm reading a Canadian and a woman. I feel pretty good about that. I kind of am what I eat, so I end up reading, like, a lot of male American novelists, and I'm trying to get better about that now. I used to be better when I was younger. You know, I read a lot of stuff in translation, and I read a lot more women and stuff like that. And it's just been the last, you know, 5-6 years, I think I've just been reading a lot of American male novels, and I feel that's not right. So I've been kind of changing my reading patterns of late.
Well, yeah, sort of related to that is, you know, when we over a year and a half ago, when we got together on Pharos, myself and Aaron Talwar, that's a publisher at Dark Horse Press, we partnered with Harry Kirshner, who was just retiring after about 30 years in this industry from IPS, Ingram Publisher Services, our distributor. He had this idea for Pharos, and then it also solved sort of this backlist problem that Dark Horse really wanted to get out in front of. So we partnered and started on Pharos. And just like anything, you know, the luck of the draw with signing rights was we cast the net out wide to, you know, over 24 authors, male and female, equally. And the books, just by luck of the draw, that came in were 4 all-male novels with 4 introducers that were men. And it kind of bummed me out a bit. You never have any intention of doing that. But the next couple ones, other than these first 4, are we've got Cheryl Strayed signed on to do a really cool lost collection of stories called Lists of the Past by Julie Hayden, which I believe had stories in The New Yorker over 30 years ago, but had fallen out of print. I think the last edition, or the only edition, was Viking. So I'm excited to bring that back. And then Lydia Yaknovich, who's so wonderful in Portland, she chose 2 lost short novels by Theodora Keough, who I believe is the granddaughter of Roosevelt.
Cool.
And those are Tattooed Heart and My Name is Rose. And Theodora Keough's got this weird history because she was an expat in Paris, and I don't know if it was in the vein of Anais Nin or what, but when a lot of literary writers, female literary writers, were getting cast off into erotica, they wouldn't give her a real deal, and they just cast her off into some weeklies and only published excerpts of those 2 books in erotica magazines, and she got the shaft, and she got left out of the whole conversation. So it's fun for me as a publisher to go dig those stories out and bring the books back.
God, now I just wish I could be in every season, because I can think of about, you know, 6 or 7 other books I'd like to sort of rescue now. But, you know, you guys have got to just keep going with different authors each time.
Hadn't mentioned the last 2. So McTeague that you picked and Sherman picked Inside Moves, and the last 2 are Mac Renning picked this wonderful, really forgotten crime noir novel called You Play the Black and the Red Comes Up. That was originally published in 1938 by Richard Hellis, which is a pen name for Eric Knight that wrote Lassie Come Home.
Yeah.
The only noir novel, and he was a Brit, and the Brit said he sounded too American, and the American said he sounded too British. So it never got much love. Black Lizard brought it back in their kind of mass market dime store version in the 70s, which I guess is what Mac Renning read it as a teenager, and it had been out of print since then. But it's just this wacky, you know, California hard-boiled novel of a kind of a patsy, this rube that shows up in L.A. looking for his runaway wife and kid, and 2 brothers that run a gambling, an illegal casino, try to pin a crime on him, and backfires, and he ends up with all the money.
Is it a funny novel? Because it's kind of been characterized as a sort of noir, but you would just figure, since it's Matt's pick, it would be hilarious.
Yep. Yeah, you know, he would have to find some type of, you know, some angle of humor in it. It's outright funny. It's also a product of the time. It's got a lot of, you know, extremely incorrect racial slurs in it and everything that we had to leave in, and we wanted to leave in. There was actually, that was a product of signing the rights. We went back and got the original printing of the text, because somewhere in the 60s, there had been an academic printing that was redacted and politically correct. They wiped all the swears and the slurs out of it.
Yeah, I just did in this vein, I wrote an intro for Melville's Typee, which Tyson, who set us up with this, podcast, actually published, and that book had undergone just horrible, horrible editorial stewardship since its beginning by Melville's brother and by his British publisher, and so it was kind of cool. Tyson got it together in really kind of the first, I believe, like really the first edition that was ever actually definitive, like, you know, as it should have been, because of stuff that had been redacted and, like I said, really poor editorial stewardship. Yeah. Talk about a racy book for its time, you know?
Right. Yeah, You Play the Black too, you know, but it is outright funny. And then the last book that you said you were really excited to read, which, I, you know, it's really great to have almost all the books from, I think, launching all four Pacific Northwest, at least in origin authors. The last one, The Land of Plenty by Robert Cantwell, Jess Walter picked, and it's about a strike at a lumber mill set in Aberdeen, Washington. So it's great to have this sort of a little bit on the back of the Frank Norris era, going up into the early 20s, you've got the, you know, a progressivist labor novel. But it's, again, like you said, these books that get better with age. The book is written incredibly episodically and quick. And for how big of a book it is, I think it's, you know, almost 400 pages. It's so engrossing and it moves so quickly. And one of the great characteristics of it is that Cantwell really humanized workers and the managers and the bosses. So it's not just some early 20th century proletarian novel.
Yeah. You know, what's so cool about this is that, you know, any one of us could end up being that author that falls into the cracks, you know what I mean? So it's so glad to have things in place that can rescue them. I mean, if there weren't, I mean, if you think about how, you know, I mean, Stanley Elkin would be completely out of print probably if it weren't for,
right.
What is it? For, what are they called? Not milkweed.
Something.
Oh, I'm trying to. I'm drawing a blank. And who was it that brought all of Elkin's work?
Dalkey.
Yeah, right. Dalkey Alcott. And then, you know, I think Portis basically went out of print as well, if it weren't for Overlook.
Yeah, and exactly. He had that renaissance recently.
You know, I mean, it's important. I think that it's, you know, we deal so much, being in the business, we deal so much with contemporary and you know, the current market and just trying to, you know, work on the life support system for our industry. I just think it's so important to keep these sorts of programs in place. I mean, when you think about, you know, if we didn't have this sort of backwards-looking, you know, backwards-looking mechanism in place, I mean, you know, Dickens wasn't even really accepted by the Academy till the 70s. Do you know what I mean? He was just written off as sentimental and everything. And then in the 70s, the Academy sort of kind of brought Dickens back, or at least brought him back in a different light. Kind of, you know, acknowledged that, well, gosh, when you think about it, this guy completely subverted the Victorian novel. He was arguably the first novelist to ever use the form as an instrument for social change. Changed the whole focus of literature from the landed gentry and the, you know, the rich classes to the street. And you know, I don't think that really, that conversation really much happened for about 70 or 80 years when people talked about Dickens. I mean, they talked about butchers named Mr. Cutty Meat, and you know, but I don't think anybody was giving him really serious consideration until the 70s in the Academy.
Yeah, I think, you know, and I think what we're dealing with now in this industry, with, you know, everybody knows every week how much significant change is going on. But I think it's also, as readers and as people, you know, we're dealing with such a massive flood of information and content that, I don't know, I think just in this massive sea of,
you know,
being able to get anything you want, you almost don't know what to pick or what's good. So it's nice to run a small little imprint that at least is curated by authors that people are reading now, that they either like or they, you know, they'd be interested in their opinion, but also to just go back through that massive flood of out-of-print books, which anybody would have, you know, over a dozen that they'd want to rescue and save, and, you know, really dig into the history of each book. One of the cool things we did with the first four Pharaohs titles was we went back in the archives and we pulled original review quotes from the 30s and 40s and from the era that they were all published in. And so the flat copy has original quotes. But it's just it's so engrossing to look at this as a historical process too, and not just a publishing endeavor.
Totally. And, you know, I mean, it's an honor to be, I'm giddy. It makes me giddy to see my name on the cover of a book with Frank Norris or Melville. It's, you know, obviously pretty awesome. You know, I mean, it's as exciting as having one of my own books released, to just have your name, you know, linked forever to somebody you admire so much, and such a huge influence on you.
So
and I think that the key is clearly is Norris's masterwork. You know, I mean, The Octopus is this awesome work of muckraking, and it's great. It's totally evocative and also brutal, but I think it was a little bit more of a political polemic. I think it was a little unwieldy at times. Norris is, you know, McTeague is just so tight and so focused, and I just think brilliant. And, you know, the end, what is it, Eric Vaughn, whatever, that famous film they made called Greed, I think it was never finished or something. It was made in the 20s. I should know this.
24, 29.
Yeah, that movie was based on McTeague. So, like, so many people that really know about it are, like, film students and, you know, cinemaphiles.
Yeah, we were going to try to put the Wanted poster from it, the original film poster from Greed. We were going to try to put it on the flat copy, but we couldn't get a good enough capture of it. So on your end, in your world, give a little update. What have you been up to? Revised Fundamentals of Caregiving is making the rounds.
Yep, almost done. I've got to go. I think I got the town hall event here in a couple days, and then after that, I head to the Oregon coast for 3 or 4 dates, and I get to bring my 3-year-old son on that, which is going to be fun and interesting. And then I get to take a sabbatical. I have 2 novels that are essentially finished arc-wise, you know, like they have a beginning, middle, and an end, but I really want to revisit both of them for, you know, maybe like 6 months each. They both need, a little reinvention, and so I'm excited just to be back in, you know, I mean, I love being on the road. I have a great time, and I feel extremely fortunate to have done 6 national tours in 5 years. I've been in 39 states in the past 5 years, and that is all well and good. I gotta tell you, I'm just really stoked to get my head back in the work and just the work. You know, so I have all summer to just think about the work. Then I have a few more dates in September, and then after that, I'm not going to do anything until the next book is published. So I might get all shaggy. I might go into my Jim Morrison stage and get all shaggy and just kind of hole up here in the mountains.
Just keep the gut down.
Yeah, I'll try. I'm vain.
Keep the beer gut down.
Yeah. Now the truth is, I'm probably going to be doing some detox, and I need to change the old lifestyle. The road is hard on the old liver. Of course, at home, you know, I'm not a big drinker because I get up at 4:30, 5 o'clock a.m. to write. And plus, you know, you don't want to drop your kids. So, you know, I mean, drinking is not a big part of my gestalt at home. But when you had 100 travel days a year, I mean, I drink like a total degenerate. And, you know, I mean, I got to feel like it's catching up with my liver at some point.
Well, I feel you. So what are these new books? You said after Revise, you've got the Dream Life of Huntington Sales, is that right?
Yeah. They're very different novels. One of them is very focused, sort of third-person limited, kind of I would characterize it as a rather quiet novel called Harriet Chance, about an 87-year-old woman. And one of them is very sort of kind of brash, world-beating, multiple point of view exercises and subjectivity that employs like really diverse and disconnected thematics, like schizophrenia, commercial logging, country music, global conspiracy theories. So it's kind of akin to West here in that I'm just trying to risk falling flat on my face, you know, which is so fun. I mean, it's such a challenge. I have all these divergent themes. I have 16 limited points of view. Meanwhile, I'm trying to subvert the thriller apparatus. So there's a lot going on, and it's really kind of the antithesis of Harriet Chance, which, like I said, is a very quiet novel. I've noticed now at this point in my career that's kind of my MO, to write a book like that or West of Here every time. It's such a critical and formal challenge. Yeah. After that, I need a story where I can sort of get up inside it a little bit more, something a little more intimate. So in terms of the writing process, I've been going back and forth. You know, I do one of these kind of formally challenging books, and then I'll write one that's a little quieter and more focused.
Well, I hope you get that time. end of the summer.
Oh, I will. I'm going to finally start saying no for the first time in my career. Glad I haven't done it up to this point, but I just need to, you know, I need to have more time with my family and more time for the work, or otherwise what am I out there supporting, you know?
That's right. Well, thanks for doing this, and
oh, pleasure. Course, thanks for including me in Pharos, and I look forward to the event on tomorrow, right?
Yeah, and I'll see you tomorrow night at Town Hall.
Not
7
that this
o'clock.
Makes an interesting radio conversation, but what time is the event again?
7 o'clock.
Okay, good. I just want to make sure I get there.
Your name's on the marquee, so you need to be there.
Oh, really? Okay. Well, that'll help me find it, because I can't remember where Town Hall is. It's somewhere on First Hill, right?
Yeah. Okay. It's in that strange part on the other side of the convention center up the hill.
All right. Well, I will find it, and I will be there, and I will be close to sober.
All right, and thank you to Tyson and Rare Bird Lit for having us on radio today.
All right. Check them out. Pharos Editions, man. Buy the whole set. I think that's how they should be sold.
PharosEditions.com. They're all in stores now. Check them out. And if you're in the Seattle area, come see us tomorrow night at Town Hall. Thanks, Johnny.
See you, buddy.
Bye.
Left you on the debris. people know you got the money. And I wonder what you would have done without me